call the House Committee on Education, the Subcommittee on Higher Education to order. It is Wednesday, February 7th, and thank you all for being here. I'd like to remind folks in the audience or on the panel, if you have a cell phone, if you'd be so kind as to not only turn it down but turn it off because of the sound system in this hearing room will be disrupted. And the folks who will come to present today, just so you know, the microphones are really sensitive in this committee here, so you don't need to get close to them. If you get close to them, they kind of crackle and pop at you. So you can sit back and relax and talk, and we'll be able to hear you just fine. I'm very pleased that we're able to have an informational hearing today. We've had some, I think, very interesting information provided to us since session started on what kind of the evolution of education in our state, and the partnership between community colleges and higher ed is of particular interest to us, and we want to learn more. So with that, do we have an order, Mr. Wilson?
I think we're
as the agenda
chair of the agenda, yes.
All right, very good. So at this time, if possible, if Dr. Ed Ray and Cam Bruce Braley would come up.
Mr. Chair, can I have a personal request for a ground rule in this hearing?
Yes.
I don't want to hear any nonsense about Ohio State University.
All right. Okay. So noted, Representative Greenland.
Dr. Ray and I have a conversation.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Ed Ray, president of Oregon State University, and very pleased to have an opportunity to talk to you about our degree partnership program. You have some materials we've distributed, but let me just talk about it in the simplest possible terms. This is a program that we established originally in 1998 with our partner community college, Lynn Benton Community College, that allows students to register once, gain admission once. So, for example, they could go to Lynn Benton and simultaneously be admitted to Lynn Benton Community College and Oregon State University. They can register once for courses at both institutions online. They can pay their fees and get an assessment of their financial eligibility for support at one or the other of the institution, not have to go back and forth, not have to worry about bringing their grade records or financial records with them. It's all done seamlessly. It's been a wonderful program. That really was the prototype for what we came to understand we could try to do statewide. And obviously the large majority of the students who've participated in this degree partnership program have been Lynn Benton Community College, OSU students. But to give you a sense of where we are, last month I signed agreements that now bring us to a total of 16 of the 17 community colleges in the state that have degree partnership programs with us. It might seem that once you've done this once, you've figured it out, so just do it with everybody. As you can imagine, though, every institution is at a different place in terms of the hardware, software capabilities they have. With every institution, we have to figure out how to coordinate our counseling and advising, financial aid, support services. With every institution, we have to figure out how to get the maximum alignment between their curriculum and the curriculum on the OSU campus to try to make the whole process as seamless as possible. We have one community college yet to sign an agreement with. That community college is currently seeking a new president. I expect shortly after the new president is on board, we'll pursue a conversation about finishing having an agreement with every community college. My objective in all of this is not to capture every community college student who qualifies, who wants to complete a four-year degree, to capture them for Oregon State University. It really is to try to do what we can to make this connection between the community colleges and the universities as seamless as possible. And I've said a number of times in public that my intention, once we've concluded agreements with all 17 community colleges is to turn to my colleague university presidents and say, we now know how to do bilateral agreements with every community college in the state. Any community college you want to make an agreement with, our staff stands ready to help you and them, because they will have also figured out how to coordinate with us. So you have experience both in the community college and at OSU. We're willing to do everything we can to help you conclude an agreement as quickly and as at little cost and frustration to you as possible. And I expect, each institution will determine which are the most sensible agreements for them to have. A number of the universities, virtually all of them, have one or more, I think, community college partners. But this is a way to just really accelerate that process of connectedness among the community colleges and the universities. To give you a sense of the magnitude of the program, since this was initiated in 1998, as I said, with Lynn Benton Community College, we've had more than 5,500 students who work toward their university degrees, who began in the degree partnership program. In fall term of 2006 alone, there were more than 3,000 students enrolled in the program, and there were more than, by the autumn of 2006, 1,600 degree partnership program students who graduated from OSU since the beginning of the program. So, you know, we have an incredible need for access to affordable higher education in the state. This in and of itself is not the solution, but this is a piece of the puzzle that we think we're putting in place. And in a cumulative sense, it certainly had an impact. And if we could bring more universities into more such partnerships, it obviously would have a beneficial effect in trying to achieve that goal of greater access to affordable education. Some of the characteristics, though, of the program, I think, are understood if you look at specific cases. And so I want to mention an analysis that was done in 2005 at Lynn Benton Community College, and what they found about performance for the degree partnership program students versus more traditional transfer students who follow the existing route. What they found was that the degree partnership program students had a higher grade point average, 3.15 versus 3.06 for non-degree partnership students, had 18 fewer OSU credit hours because they're not losing credits in the transfer process. So this reduced the cost and time to degree. It's just a more aligned, cost-effective way for students to ultimately get their college degree. This is a program that actually has caught the attention of educational enterprises across the country. The program has been replicated in Michigan and Oklahoma, and is under consideration by the Kentucky Commission for Higher Education and the British Columbia Council on Admissions and Transfers. The LBCC OSU program was selected for an Innovative Program Award in 2004 by the National Association for Student Personnel Administrators. And in April 2006, OSU was invited to testify before the congressionally appointed Advisory Committee on Student Financial Assistance in Washington, D.C., as part of the committee's, quote, Innovative Pathways to Baccalaureate Degree Attainment, unquote, project. So we think this is a good program, and one that is serving students very well. And as I said, our ultimate objective is to increase that connectedness between community colleges and the universities themselves. And if I could speak to two characteristics that I think this program addresses particularly well, I'd like to. And one is, as you know, the student population of this country is becoming more and more diverse over time. And the reality is that just as the high schools are more diverse in terms of student population than the community colleges. The community colleges are more diverse than the university system in terms of their characteristics. And not only are there more diverse populations in the community colleges, but as a group, there tend to be more students who are really first-time community college or university attendees, and so they face particular difficulties in pursuing their undergraduate degrees, not having a good support network, perhaps, to see what the possibilities are with respect to their own potential educational attainment. And so I think this degree partnership program helps to recognize that there are not just non-traditional students in terms of the greater diversity of the student population, but maybe we need to think more creatively about non-traditional routes to helping students see the possibilities that are there before them, and then help them ultimately achieve their educational dreams. So with that, I'd stop there and let my colleagues speak, and obviously be happy to answer questions.
Okay, we'll be okay. I'm going to see if my colleagues have any questions for Dr. Wright.
President Greenlich, any? No. Senator Lim, any questions for Dr. Wright?
Maybe later.
If I could just take a couple minutes, I'd like to kind of get this from the student's point of view. If I'm a high school senior in Jackson County, and my counselor's talking about Rogue Community College, but also this partnership with Oregon State University. So I go and I apply at RCC, and I do the dual registration with OSU. I have the classes there in front of me of what I could take at each institution, knowing that I want to get this way for a degree.
Does you automatically get accepted at OSU?
Is it automatic?
You are accepted into OSU as a degree partnership program student, and you have all the usual requirements for appropriate academic performance to stay in good standing.
Got you. Yeah. So if you're accepted into RCC, you can be.
Yes. I mean, you are accepted simultaneously into OSU and into the community college, but then you have the same requirements to stay in good standing that any OSU student would have.
Okay.
So you have to obviously take appropriate courses and maintain an appropriate grade point.
Very good. Yes, Representative Lynn.
Thank you.
You stimulated questions from all of
us. No. And thank you very much, Dr. Ray, right?
Yes.
Okay. In your the sheet here, number three, eliminate and reduce barriers in the transfer process. What has been the most problematic barriers?
Well, I think, I worked very closely. I was on the commission for articulation and transfer in the state of Ohio when I was there at this other place that we're not going to talk about. and so I think there were two major barriers. One was students understanding how the courses they took in the community colleges mapped into courses that were acceptable or not acceptable for transfer into the universities. And in the early 1990s, we did a lot of work in that state trying to get articulation agreements about what would and would not transfer. And one of the things that you discover very quickly is transferring and counting toward your degree are not the same thing. So you can get to the point where everything transfers, but you know what? If you want to be a math major, you didn't take the right math prerequisites in the community college. So a program that we worked on there just before I left was one in which we tried to define the modules of pre-major courses that students should be advised to take before they went on to university. So, for example, you didn't have to know exactly what you were going to major in, but if you knew you were interested in, say, science or engineering, something in there, then the idea was to identify the math modules that you should be taking in community college that were the prerequisites that you needed to take subsequent math and science courses that would help you toward your degree. Well, in a sense, to the extent that we work so closely with the community colleges because of this simultaneous enrollment of students, we have very direct discussions about not only course numbers but course content while they're in the courses that they're taking in the community college, so that in fact they match up as seamlessly as possible with what they would take if they started as new freshmen at the university itself. And I know, for example, in the area of engineering, our colleagues in engineering have worked, particularly with Lynn Benton, very closely with them on the pre-engineering program. So in a way, through this program, we're dealing both with does it transfer and does it count toward my major, all in the same step. So it's just a much more effective way to really address what I came to discover where I came from, were two of the biggest bottlenecks to students moving through as quickly and effectively as possible.
One more follow-up.
Priscilla.
So as a legislator, it seems like working well currently, but any areas we can help?
Well,
of course, asking more funding, but you know.
Well, I think, you know, again, it's I don't want to be presumptuous about what other universities can and can't do and how quickly they can do it, but there always are issues about the availability of staffing for counseling, advising, the availability of software, hardware that can be interconnected between the universities and the community colleges. I'm not sure that they're significant resource issues, but they're not insignificant issues. So I don't know if there's something from a resource standpoint, I think Cam might have a better sense of that, that the legislature might be able to do to expedite the spread of this capacity across community college and university systems. But I know in our own efforts to work with individual community colleges, it's taken a number of years. And for some of them, it's been that, you know, they had to wait until they had the wherewithal to buy the software to have our people, our computer people, work with them on integrating their electronic records with our records. So I wouldn't bet that there aren't some modest resource issues that are still there. For some of them, we've got it. We're fine. But there may be other universities in partnering with community colleges who could use some help to do things faster and more effectively.
Thank you, Doctor.
That's excellent. If I can keep going then with the
sure.
My student from Jackson County, let's say he wants to major in math, and he's enrolled in both institutions. The counseling for his academic path, does that come from OSU, or does it come from at community college level? Who helps that student figure out how they're going to navigate through this?
We coordinate those efforts. So more likely than not, if the student went to the counseling staff in Rogue Community College, those people would have been in communications with the counseling people at OSU about what are the appropriate prerequisites, for example, for math, and the student would be able to talk to the counselors in his or her own community college and feel pretty confident that they were getting good advice about what courses they need to be taking now for what they want to do later.
Excellent. And one last question. First, let me say this is fantastic what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Thank you for doing this work. It's tremendously exciting. In terms of the finances for a student, if my student is enrolled at Rogue Community College, do I have this correct? Maybe he's taking three courses mm-hmm. at Rogue Community College. Does he actually maybe come to your university at some point while he's still in his freshman or sophomore year and take a course and then come back again? And how does that payment work?
Students actually switch back and forth in whatever way makes the most sense to them. Plus, we use eCampus. We use online availability of courses for students. So for a student from Rogue Community College, that's a pretty good trip back and forth. You not want to do it a lot of times in a given day. But you know, if they're using electronic access to courses, then at Rogue Community College, they could be doing an online course at OSU at the same time that they're doing the Rogue Community College courses. And what's really terrific about it is for students to apply, for example, for Perkins loans and other financial aid, typically you have to be carrying a full credit load. Right. If you're carrying 9 credit hours at Rogue Community College and 3 credit hours at OSU, you're a full-time student. So to the extent, again, if you think about access and affordability, if you think about students who, without financial support, they cannot take a full load.
Right.
And they're working and they're going to Rogue Community College. Well, for them, they might be thinking, you know, I can only take 1 or 2 courses at a time. Maybe I can get to 3 some quarters because I've got this job and I've got to juggle everything. Well, now all of a sudden we can say, hey, you know what? If you actually take 1 more course, you can qualify for financial aid, even though you're on-site at Rogue Community College all the time. Now you can qualify for financial aid. Maybe you don't have to work so much to pay for your college education. Maybe you can focus on it more and get done faster. Now, obviously, in a place like Lynn Benton Community College, we actually have a bus that is free because we're, you know, essentially 10 miles apart. And we have, it's kind of swirling. You know, students will have a morning class at Lynn Benton and an afternoon class at in Corvallis and go back to Lynn Benton for an early, late afternoon or early evening course. I mean, it really is pretty seamless because of the lack of distance barriers. But again, as I said, for a student at Rogue Community College, you know, as good as online instruction is becoming and the support services for it, they can, in a sense, virtually be on both campuses at the same time. We even have the capacity, and obviously Lynn Benton Community College students take advantage of this more than others, but students who are simultaneously enrolled have access to our library resources, have access to our career counseling resources, can get student tickets to athletic events. I mean, we really make the whole thing as seamless as we possibly can.
Wow, that's fantastic. Any other questions for Dr. Ray? We can come back to them afterwards. But thank you so much for your testimony. Thank you very much for your work. Please stay around if you would, and if other questions come up, if you have time to do so.
Sure.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Cam Preuss-Brawley, the Commissioner of Community Colleges, Director of the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. I have a handout in front of you. It's difficult to follow Dr. Ray and his examples of the really fantastic things that are happening across the state, but particularly, as you said, because of the geographic circumstances between Lynn Benton and Oregon State University. They're really the poster child for how degree partnership programs can work. But having said that, they can still work even when you are not geographically connected, as your example between Rogue Community College and Oregon State and online. The handout that you have in front of you, I want to skim through it very quickly just to sort of provide perhaps a context within which this happens. Slide number 2 at the very bottom is this is a picture of how the public education system acts and interacts together between the joint boards of education, the State Board of Education, the Workforce Board. But if you look at that very bottom platform piece, that's the Education Enterprise Target, which talks about setting a target in the next 15, 20 years that we're going to incredibly and critically increase the number of associate and bachelor degreed individuals in the state of Oregon because our economic vitality depends on it. You've just heard a very compelling reason about, or a very compelling example of how we're going to go about that a step at a time, moving 5,500 students in the last several years through from high school through a baccalaureate. And as Dr. Ray said, it's a model across the nation. I'm going to skip 3, 4, and 5. I'm going to expect that you are well schooled in the more you learn, the more you earn. Slide number 6 is a picture of where the 17 community colleges are across the state. And as Dr. Ray said, he only has one more before he has fully signed up all 17 community colleges with a degree partnership program. And I'm certain that as soon as Tillamook Bay Community College has their new president, they'll be signing up. On slide number 7, when we start the legislative session, we do a scan of all 17 colleges and ask them about their goals and what's their vision and mission statements, because we represent all 17 when we come before you. And so slide 7 really gives you a snapshot of what those mission statements say. And I want to bring to your attention the last two, goal attainment and success, affordability and accessibility, certainly documented in the degree partnership program. Slide number 8, community colleges across the state are comprehensive beings or entities. They provide, you could call it soup to nuts, you could call it from pre-collegiate through adult enrichment courses. Very key to that is under lower division college transfer, but these co-enrollment or degree partnership programs. Quite specifically on slide 9, they did begin establishment in the late 1990s. The precursor to that was a partnership between the university system and the community college called something called university centers, where the legislature actually in the middle 90s and through the late 90s actually invested maybe $100,000 in a community college so that the universities could bring four-year baccalaureate programs there. And they did that across the state, primarily at Eastern, because of the need for, and Blue Mountain and Treasure Valley, very remote locations to be able to have access to baccalaureate degrees, and EOU helped fill that need. Southern and Rogue had a similar, and then the Southern Oregon Community College in Coos Bay had a university center. So there have been precursor programs, but it was still, I would say, to Dr. Ray's early example, it's still somewhat difficult for a student to navigate their way, even if there was a university center. And the real beauty here is that there are wraparound services for a student who wants to participate and be enrolled at both of a university and a community college at the same time. Actually, my information says that the first co-enrollment program was between Clackamas Community College and Portland State. This is one of those, what was the very first community college in the state? There's always a lot of debate about exactly who that was and when that was. But it has grown to where the Portland Metro colleges now have something called the Portland Metro Consortium, where and it's expanding down to Chemeketa, where there's a real push for greater and greater transfer and articulation between programs, not just admission, but actual programs. And then, of course, Oregon State, major player in the rural parts of the state. The purpose behind the programs, and I'm just emphasizing what Dr. Ray said, it's really supporting success for students and persistent, and it's to expand their options so that when they're at one institution, they can really be at two and sometimes three. Slide 11, I wanted to just bring your attention. Again, this is Oregon State and Lynn Benton, but there's a third player, and that's Central Oregon Community College. They actually have a three-way partnership mm-hmm. for an engineering degree because Central Oregon doesn't have all the engineering courses that they need. So they're actually three-way enrolled, and as they get near finishing up at Central Oregon, then they can go to Lynn Benton, finish there with an Associate of Science transfer degree, and be admitted to Oregon State. Clackamas has a similar one. I'm trying to make examples so that you know that there are, to Representative Lim's point, there are articulation agreements, and then there is the broad AAOT, which is the Associate of Arts transfer degree, all of which help the student make the make a seamless transition. Also, Representative Lemieux asked about barriers. We actually have two program option packages in the CCWD budget. One is an acronym called OFACS, the Oregon Financial Aid Exchange. The programs that we're talking about, the co-enrollment and degree partnership programs, will be helped by all 24 institutions in the state having software that talks about the financial aid receipt for each student, which we currently don't have. So that's an important barrier to remove. Also, in the university system budget, there's the expansion of ATLAS, which is an acronym that I can't give you all the names for, but someone in the room I'm sure could give you what they all mean. But that's a automated transcript so that students can, no matter where they are, they can say, I've taken these kinds of courses, where can I transfer if I want X kind of degree? So I bring those two to your attention. Again, I think the reality of the degree partnership programs are that it's helping more students advance to degrees and certificates without us throwing up additional barriers in their way, and it's really the whole purpose. Thank you.
Questions? Mr. Cromwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being here today. I apologize for being a little bit late, and Dr. Ray, you may have covered this, so if you did, I apologize. When a student is involved in the co-op program or specifically the degree, the DPP, the
degree partnership program.
Yeah, that's the one. What fees does the student pay? Do they pay the fees that are generally associated with Oregon State University, or do they pay the fees that are associated with the community college,
they
or
pay
kind
the,
of a hybrid?
They pay the fees that are associated with the point of origin for the courses. So to the extent they're taking 9 courses at Rogue Community College and 3 courses there and 1 course or 3 credit hours at OSU, then they pay a blended rate. And in fact, I know a number of colleagues have done estimates about, given the coordination among the content of courses to make it as seamless as possible to move through, there are calculations about how much money students can save on an undergraduate degree by using this combined path, that it is a more cost-effective path just in terms of absolute dollars for the students.
Okay. Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Here, sir.
Is the old-fashioned way still available? And
yes.
What I mean by that is, I'm a product of the old-fashioned way, really old-fashioned, which was I went to. They're now called community colleges. In those days, they were called junior colleges. Spent a couple of years there, collected a bunch of credits, transferred into a university. I think there was actually only. I was 10 hours short because they didn't accept one of my classes. My grade wasn't very good in it. But the rest of my credits all transferred into a university, which actually was in a different state from the community college that I went to. And then, of course, when I ended up graduating college, I had way more credits than I needed for a variety of reasons. But I was just wondering if that being the old-fashioned way, if that's still available for
Representative Crummell, we still have students who come through traditional transfer efforts, and that's why it's important to continue to work on making the articulation and transfer process itself as seamless as possible and to get alignment between prerequisites that students take in the community college and the universities as crisply defined as possible. And I was saying that I came here from Ohio and served on the statewide articulation and transfer commission. And those were two sets of issues that we dealt with over time. What's advantageous about the degree partnership program is, in a sense, both get addressed simultaneously because it's not just a matter of take 3 courses here, a course there. There's also access to the advice and counseling, and the effort of educators in both institutions to agree on course content, regardless of where the course is taught, so that students, in fact, are able to transfer and have, not just transfer and have count, but have count toward their degrees, more of the credits that they take at the community college location. So I gave examples, I think perhaps before you arrived, that in terms of the grade point average for Lynn-Benton Community College students, that the degree partnership program students had average GPAs of 3.15 versus 3.06 for traditional transfer students to OSU, and that toward their degree they had 18 fewer OSU credit hours. So in effect, as a result of the degree partnership program, not only did their credits get transferred over in count, but they were getting good counseling on which math sequence they needed to take if they wanted to be an engineer or whatever. And in fact, the engineering program is one where our faculty in engineering have worked very well with colleagues at Lynn-Benton Community College to make sure that students that think they may have an interest in engineering or science are in fact getting good advice on which math and science courses they need to take through the community college. If I had to sort of characterize what's happening over time, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but what I see happening is that the absolute number of students who are coming to us is growing, but also that the degree partnership program population is growing at the expense of the traditional transfer path. And I think it's just simply a reflection of that. Embodied in the DPP program are some of the characteristics that, in a more generic sense, we're still struggling to get into our articulation and transfer agreements for traditional transfer students. So it's I guess I would characterize it as a more streamlined version of the old transfer model.
Okay. So you haven't, if I may, Mr. Chair, so you haven't really taken anything away. Is
no.
These are just
right.
additional pathways
right.
for students to be able to use to get where it is that they're trying to go, which is that that ultimate degree.
Yeah, and students who have the choice are systematically shifting to the degree partnership program because they can see the advantages.
Sure.
The kind of thing that I mentioned, that you don't take empty credits. I mean, that's sort of it's like in the construction business, you don't like to hear about change orders.
Right.
In the education business, you don't like to hear about empty credits.
This is true.
Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, I'm going to say, might not directly connect it, the subject we have discussed, but my question is, what percentage of the university student their tuition paid by the parents, and how many students by the scholarships, whatever, Pell Grant, whatever, and how many students are self-supporting? And do you have any vague idea of that? Because the reason why I'm asking, that the education system continually shifting to the burden of taxpayers, but the country I came from, Korea, responsibility belongs to their parents. You know, most of them, they pay for their college educations from their parents. So I just want a system comparison between of those countries.
Well, I can give you some broad
idea,
measures. If you look at where we are with respect to on instructional dollars, how much comes from the state, how much comes from the student and or his or her family, 5-6 years ago, 60% support came from the state, 40% from the student and family. Today, it's more like 62% from the student and or family and 38% from the state. So there has been a reversal, and you all have been party to discussions about what are we going to do about historic tuition increases and the impact that has on access and affordability. Another piece I can tell you about is what we do with respect to the financial aid that we provide, and one element of which is fee remissions. We provide approximately 78% of the financial aid that we provide to students who, by federal standards, typical standards, would in fact qualify for need-based aid. Mm-hmm. So to the extent we can have an offsetting role on what's happened to the relative role that the state and the student and family have played in funding higher education, we've worked very systematically to put most of our financial aid into helping students who obviously merit the opportunity but lack the financial resources to be able to be successful. So those are two pieces of sort of where we stand now. I don't have with me specific information on to what extent students versus families pick up that non-state supported or non-institution financial aid supported part of their costs.
Follow up?
Or is it them?
Okay, I forgot. That's just with the age.
Mitch, I represent Mitch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the difference in cost per credit hour between, say, Lynn Benton Community College and OSU? And is the student essentially paying the same amount, whichever place they're...
No, as I said earlier, and you may have missed it, that the student pays the cost of the credit hours where the credit hours are taken. So the cost at the community college is typically somewhat less. And so if they take a blended schedule where they're taking some but not all of their courses at OSU, it's actually a less expensive path if we have the kind of coordination and alignment that we do have through the degree partnership program. So one of the ways...
You have a sense of what the
ways
value of those are?
Pardon? I don't know what Lynn Benton's. I know Rita Cavan, I think, is here.
I know the average.
What's the average for them?
It's the Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee. The average community college tuition is about $68 a credit hour.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And I can't. I'm sure that Dr. Cavan could tell us the specific.
Well, ours is about almost $1,800 per quarter for a full-time credit load, and a full-time credit load could be 12 to 16 because we have a plateau which the other universities have eliminated.
It's
so it's not quite as...
$1,800
for 12 to 16 credit hours. So it's obviously, it's even if you took 16, it's probably $20 per credit hour versus what was it, 68?
So maybe twice, I mean, roughly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, somewhat a little bit less maybe than twice. So there can be a real cost saving if a student blends. And they do that. I mean, that's part of what we, and certainly colleagues at community colleges, talk about, that this is a more cost-effective way if you get it right and the partnership works for students on from ordinary circumstances to get their education funded.
Representative Klim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The OFACS package, that is a program option package. It's in the governor's budget. Okay. I just want to flag people's attention that if we like this concept, we like this idea. Part of that is the data systems. And the program was initially developed, some of it was developed down at the Student Assistance Commission back when they were doing student loans, but it needs additional work to bring in all the other people, and that's why it needs funding. I think it's being moved elsewhere, too, to a place that is better on the data side and has more technology. Yeah. Mr. Chair, I also can't just let it go. I mean, we have in our presence the president, I call him Grand Emperor, the 2006 Sun Bowl champion, 2006 College World Series champion. This year just pitched the first shutout since 1967?
40 years.
Yeah, in our presence.
I was going to put ring on too.
So, I noticed the ring. Yeah.
This year's Beavers did.
Oh, but not
personally. Although I take full credit for it.
Is this the part where we get down and kiss his ring?
Would you
bring it up so that we can?
I think after the hearing's closed, you may engage with the ring.
One more little one. The Portland Metro partnership sounds really great. I'm just wondering if at some point we can keep the farmland between the true metro and Chemeketa farmland and maybe call it the Willamette Valley, you know, addendum, something like that. I'm just, you know, for the record.
It's going to be
thank you, Mr. O'Clellan.
Thank you.
Thank you both very much. I hope
2 years from now, you'll be able to come back and say that all of our higher ed institutions and all of our community colleges are developing the partnerships. It's a wonderful work, and it's a benefit to the students of the state of Oregon. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, let's see if Representative Clem knows our next witness, too. Can I call Robert Mercer? Please come forward.
Chair Buckley, members of the committee, my name is Robert Mercer. I live at 1903 Northeast Hancock in Portland. I work for the Chancellor's Office in Enrollment and Student Services. And I am here to talk to you a little bit about the ATLAS project. It's kind of nice when an acronym actually resonates with the meaning of the thing you're talking about. And so the ATLAS project, which stands for, and I have to read it, Articulation Transfer Linked Audit System. It's Oregon's initiative to create a centralized degree audit and articulation program that will ease students' transfer from community colleges to OUS and among OUS institutions. Students can use this statewide system to see how coursework will transfer from one institution to another. ATLAS will take Oregon's higher education institutions to a new level of online accessible advising. It allows institutions the ability to publish course-by-course equivalency guides, full academic programs, transfer course evaluations for students, and degree audits, similar to the degree audits that exists for on-campus students in a very accessible web environment. Successful completion of this project will allow students and their advisors to employ coursework from any of the 24 post-secondary institutions in Oregon to help students plan the most efficient paths to their degrees. One of the things that is from somebody who's spent a career doing academic advising that is really wonderful about this is that it allows the opportunity for students to match their coursework and their interests with majors offered at all the public institutions in the university system. It allows for the diversity and richness of offerings of all our campuses while providing clear, accurate, accessible information that students need to make decisions about their degree choices. So if I can, because I'm not a technology person, if I can use your student, say, who is down in Southern Oregon who's interested in being a math major. Admittedly, a lot of math majors are fairly similar, especially at the lower division level. But that student can go in and match her coursework or his coursework in their major, in their general education requirements, in the degree requirements, against the requirements for a math degree at Eastern Oregon, Western Oregon, at PSU, and determine where do I stand at any given point relative to my progress towards that degree, and what are the options among those. If I were to get University of Oregon offers a Bachelor of Arts or a Bachelor of Science in math. How would that be different, and how would my coursework match up? It will allow students to request two different kinds of audits. So the student from Rogue could send their transcripts to Portland State and say, I'm a history major, what do I still need? And request something that lists all the Portland State course requirements, or they can request an audit which, say, match that to Rogue's course offerings so that what I get back is a list that says, of the remaining courses that I still need, here are the numbers of the courses at Rogue that match what I still need to graduate. In math, it's pretty straightforward. But if you think about, say, for example, anthropology, where we have And I think we strongly believe in having a variety of options for students who are interested in anthropology. One campus that maybe focuses primarily in physical anthropology, another that focuses in cultural, social anthropology for a wide variety of reasons. This allows for that diversity at the same time that it allows students to determine which campus meets their needs and is the best match for their existing coursework.
Very good. Questions, gentlemen?
I do have a question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Carroll.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. A couple of years ago, I became interested, I became aware of a particular articulation program between Oregon State University Southern Oregon Community College. That's the one in Coos Bay, right? It's a very innovative program, and it was based on a curriculum program that OSU has had for a number of years, and the community college sort of stepping in and being able to fill some of those roles. And so, in my understanding of it, because of the articulation agreement, is that a student who is accepted at Southern Oregon Community College, then in that particular program, automatically then is able to be, assuming successful completion with the proper grade point average and all of that kind of stuff, then is able to enroll for the last 2 years at Oregon State University to finish and is automatically in that particular program. Is that how this whole system, and then of course they would go to OSU and finish up and get their bachelor's degree in the program. Is that how this Atlas system works? Am I describing correctly?
No, I think you're describing a dual partnership or articulation agreement. Exactly. The one thing I wouldn't assume necessarily, is I think that there are programs within the Oregon University system where that require an additional admissions step. So okay. I don't know, for example, the program that you're describing, say if it were engineering and students must do some additional thing at the junior level, whether they would automatically be admitted into a professional school based on the articulation agreement. But this, I think, is the Atlas system isn't really based on students being admitted into any kind of a dual enrollment program or participating in any kind of articulation agreement.
Oh, okay.
It's any student who's going to a community college in Oregon or the Oregon University system who basically wants to take their credits and compare them with the requirements of any OUS institution and eventually community college to determine how do the credits that I've already taken, if I've taken them at, I spent some time at Clackamas, I spent some time at Portland Community College, I spent a year at Oregon State. We all know people like that. I am one of those people. And now, how do I package those things and compare them? One of the things, so it doesn't involve necessarily having filled out a particular application. It's merely accessing the requirements to make the best decisions about their futures.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Will there be a charge to use this system for students in Oregon? This will be provided free?
Yeah, absolutely.
And you don't have to be enrolled, or they'll just be available as a resource for parents?
You need college credits from a school that we recognize.
I see, okay.
I can give you an example. Currently, at an individual basis, Portland State does this right now.
Right.
It's not called the Atlas Project. It's called CAS, Course Applicability System. And they have worked it out so that they also include, among the community colleges, they include all the Oregon private institutions as well, and they include a number of Washington State community colleges from which they get a number of transfer students.
Wow.
They're right now, and Mark's going to talk about the next phases of Atlas and IDTS. Right now, for the Portland State system, students are required to input their coursework. They go online. Anybody in the world can create an account.
Okay.
If you wanted to see how it could work, you could create an account for yourself and make up a transcript.
Gotcha.
And match it to see how it worked and how it transferred. And one of the interesting outcomes, not necessarily unexpected outcome, but because for Atlas to work, all the OUS campuses must have automated degree audit systems for their own students, because what Atlas is providing access to a degree audit for people who are currently not students at that institution. It's pushed our institutions probably faster than they were prepared to move to automate their degree auditing systems, with all the challenges they have for resources and technology and everything. But it means this project is also helping better serve the students who are currently enrolled at those OUS institutions in terms of advising and tracking.
What do you think will be the major outcome of having the system fully in place? In a nutshell, how will it benefit students the most? Will we retain more students? Will more students graduate from Oregon universities?
Well, let me tell you, if I can use a PSU example, because that's my background, so
okay.
I don't intend to favor one school. It's just the one I know the most about. In terms of automated degree audits, I served for a number of years as the chair of what was the Academic Requirements Committee at Portland State, which, among other things, reviewed petitions by students who were requesting some kind of a waiver of a requirement, almost always based on misinformation, on saying, I received the wrong information. The year after we had fully implemented our campus degree audit, I could report to the Faculty Senate that the number of petitions for students saying I was given misinformation cut 65%. Of 600 and some petitions. I mean,
wow.
And part of that had to do with accurate, immediate information. Part of that policy package that you mentioned, the OFACS, that has the data warehouse system, has the ability to track students' movements from one sector to another. Because we've been less able to track sort of the number of students who transfer and the number of credits and everything. But I can tell you that when PSU flipped the switch for their version of Atlas,
mm-hmm.
with no publicity of any kind, and this has to do with, I think, the technology savviness of people younger than I, in the first week, 500 students set up accounts to compare their transcripts against PSU courses, because they, and the only way they could have known that was they were messing around on the web. And so, I mean, that's a huge...
Yeah, an instant message on Earth and all.
Yeah. I think maybe you're right. So I really think, in terms of getting students, as President Ray said, to graduation with fewer credits, to getting students the information they need to make the best decisions, to help advisors feel confident that they are giving students the best information. It doesn't, you know, the one issue that it maybe necessarily doesn't address is if a student doesn't know what their major is, the more credits they accumulate while they're undecided, the more likely they will end up with more than the minimum number of credits they needed at graduation. And I don't think technology or anything else can fix that.
Mr. Chair, that's really an important issue that Dr. Ray pointed out, the 18 hours fewer. Well, in 18 hours, but that's maybe two terms and maybe $2,000 to $4,000 in expenses. That's a very important difference. Huge difference. Yeah. Yeah, almost lost wages. Well, I'm down there playing pinochle instead of being at the class.
So, Richard, thank you so much. I appreciate the information greatly. Gentlemen, we do have some information on the integrated data transfer system, as promised. Mark Ensley and Doug Costi, I think, are both here. Did you both want to come up, or were we just...
Doug looks so surprised.
Doug might have just thought he was here in a backup role for providing backup, I don't know.
Chair Buckley, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark Ensley. I'm the director of K-16 alignment for the Oregon University Chancellor System. And actually, I want to be able to talk to you about two of the projects because as the director of K-16 alignment, I am in charge of implementation for both Atlas, so I can give you some details about how that's rolling out and how that impacts both OUS but also the community colleges. So I'll give you a brief update about that. And then I will talk a little bit about the integrated data transfer system.
And, Mr. Chair, for your record, my name is Doug Costi, Assistant Superintendent of Assessment and Information Services, Oregon Department of Education, K-12.
Almost exactly a year ago, the State Board of Higher Education approved funding for the Atlas Project from Chancellor's Office funds. Phase one of the project was scheduled to include all 7 OUS campuses and include a couple of different features in terms of the system that you heard described by Mr. Mercer. First off, the system itself is set up to allow information to flow two directions, one internally so that students can in fact evaluate the coursework that they're taking and the degree that they're pursuing and figure out which sort of next steps they might need to take in order to pursue that degree. But it also allows, in this case, the ability for them to sort of import information from the various campuses that they might have taken in order to limit the sort of manual entry that they have to do and the mistakes they might make in entering courses and grades that they've received at various campuses. That's the piece that actually includes the community colleges in phase one, is their ability to import those transcripts automatically into any of the 7 campus systems to make those comparisons. Even PSU system, which is operational right now, still requires manual entry. So there's a fair amount of work for students to sit down, open an account, and try to figure out everything that they've taken over the years in various places in order to make the system operational. So we think that that's an efficiency even for PSU system, that's an enhancement that I think will make it a lot more user-friendly for students. Currently, all 7 of the campuses are working on automating some of the internal systems locally that they have to develop in order to make the system work. And we're in the process of doing some additional programming that we have to do to make the system operational with our local systems. There are currently 4 other states that are working on the system. 3 of them are up statewide. So we're on the national forefront of developing this kind of integrated program in order to inform student planning. But it does mean that we've had to do a fair amount of additional programming on our own in conjunction with vendors in order to make it work with the unique systems that we have in state to make it operational. So we still believe we are on schedule for implementation in the fall of 2007. So we think at all 7 campuses there will be an installation of Atlas that allows students to move in into the program. But one of the things we did ask our campuses to do was prioritize their programs and partners initially in order to get the highest volume possible in the rollout. Now, over the next biennium and probably biennium past that, we'll continue to enhance that and add programs and partners as time goes by in order to make this a really comprehensive system that allows the maximum number of students to take advantage. That also applies to phase 2 of the project, which then involves the community colleges down the road. Currently, as I mentioned, in phase 1, they're going to be limited to the ability for students to move coursework into the OUS systems to do the analysis. down the road, we want to be able to statewide move towards the ability for them to internally within community colleges evaluate a number of programs, certifications, and other sorts of things that community colleges offer as well. Right now, I believe, without trying to speak for the community colleges, but the tentative plan that they've proposed is that in the 2009 to 11 biennium, they would look to do that sort of receiving function to build the full system. And then in the interim period, they'll work to bring on the remaining, probably there will be six or seven community colleges that won't have that initial send function, some of the smaller ones in particular, that they'll work on developing that transcript interface to allow them to at least import into the OUS system in the next biennium. So in terms of our development work, we believe on schedule, and we believe we're going to have a statewide presence here with at least all seven of our institutions ready to run at some level, at least by the time we get into the fall of this next year.
Very good. Questions, members? President Krebel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last summer, fall, sometime, interim committees that I was on, we got the opportunity to look at this, and I was under the impression, and so please correct me if I'm wrong, but I was under the impression that the integrated data transfer system was being held up because of the federal FERPA statutes. Can you help me rectify that? Is that in fact the case, or have those issues been resolved and IDTS is now well on its way to becoming a reality?
Chair Buckley, Representative Krummel, we're jumping ahead a little bit in topics, but I can before we get to the full IDTS presentation, I can tell you that we did in fact resolve the FERPA issues related to that, and I'll talk more specifically about that in the presentation itself. But yes, in fact, we were able to resolve what we were concerned about in terms of the IDTS project so that we've been able to move forward in implementation. And I think both Mr. Costi and myself will address that specifically in terms of our data transfer things when we get to those here in a second. So,
okay. Go ahead. So have you charge on it.
Okay. You do have a brief in front of you, I believe, that that describes the transfer system in general. In essence, the integrated data transfer system is an effort for us to move into at least the 20th, if not 21st century, in terms of our ability to move information. And in an era where I could currently create a document on my Macintosh and send it to your PC and you could actually receive it and read it, it seems logical that we would move to systems that didn't rely on paper. And yet Oregon is one of only a handful of states that are on the verge of being able to move information in this way. And so we are, again, on the forefront in terms of our development of technology to create these kinds of systems across sectors. Some of the complications of that have to do with the infrastructure right now. And in reality, the K-12 system alone has roughly 17 different student information systems used by high schools. And to try to figure out how we take data that's processed in a certain way and then move that onto the post-secondary side that also has its own variety of systems to translate into, it is complex. And it's a large-scale project. We've been able to accomplish a fair amount on, relatively speaking, at least fairly modest investment by the state. And so we are, in fact, on the verge. In fact, our first high school finished testing yesterday, is ready now to go live. And so the first batch of real transcripts for the system is going to begin to move this week, we believe, into the system. So Gresham High School is the first. We have Sunset High School from Beaverton hot on their heels. And so within a week or so, we're going to be moving the first high school data formally from a high school to a post-secondary institution that's happened in the entire country. Most of the other kinds of things and data systems that have been worked on nationally have been more in the form of research databases and information that hasn't been used at the same level of a student transcript to make individual student decisions. So we are at least unique in that sense and are, I think, excited about the fact that we are on the verge of now pulling in a large-scale number of schools into this process. In terms of development, we are trying to target...
Question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Grindick.
How is that information going to be kept updated? I mean, Sunset will send you data at a point in time, right? It could change momentarily.
Chair Buckley, Representative Greenlich, the processes that we're establishing are following very much the traditional procedures that we would use with paper. The difference, of course, is that the information is then stored electronically and is more accessible. Right now, obviously, a paper file comes in through the mail. It's, you know, matched with records for the student, initially through a somewhat painstaking process of last name, birth date, school, identity, and then we hope that we get a match. From there, currently, the information is matched from a student's social security number. And increasingly, that has obvious risk factors that are meaning that campuses are hesitant more and more often to use that as a primary identifier. So as part of this project, we use the state's secure identifier that's used for the state assessment system. It is unique and assigned to every Oregon student in the state. So as part of this establishment of the system, we're able to use that less risky identifier to do the matching of records, and that allows us then to update them just as we would now, except to the degree that they are stored in a database as opposed to a filing cabinet.
Can I follow up on that? When it's in a filing cabinet, at least it has a date stamp on it. Will this have a date stamp so you know when that data...
Yeah, Chair Buckley, Representative Greenlich, yes. In fact, they are date stamped as they come in. And a typical student will submit at least 3 transcripts over the course of their admission process, from the time they're first applying through sometimes a subsequent one with additional information that enhances maybe a 6th semester record or so. And then they, of course, have a final in most cases. Other students will submit more, either with clarifications or changes to a record if they have had records updated. Sometimes they're applying for other purposes, things like scholarships and other decisions like that. And so we do, in fact, have a way to track transcripts over time. And as they come in, we keep track of the sort of order and sequence and purpose for those transcripts in their record so that they can be differentiated.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
So in terms of the development of the system, one of the primary concerns we had, as Representative Krummel indicated, was the FERPA requirements of privacy. And so to the degree possible, we followed the traditional policies that mean that records are only accessible to the same parties that would have them in paper, that we aren't, in fact, making these widely available to other campuses. We've sort of maximized our security around the transfer processes and used secure methods for making sure that the transmissions are, in fact, kept private. And most of the college campuses, at least in this state, have already been working towards submitting transcripts back and forth amongst themselves. Part of the IDTS project has been to make sure that we get universal ability to both send and receive those transcripts to the post-secondary side, but it did give us some already current practices about how to protect the privacy rights of students as they move through the system. There were some procedures and policies that existed that we could build on, and so we weren't really inventing new things necessarily. We weren't making the records widely available to new audiences. It was the same people that traditionally had access to the student records. So to the degree possible, we minimized new protocols, new practices, and tried to use the sort of existing ones that were in use at the time, and that meant that we were able to minimize the FERPA issues. In essence, the questions really had more to do with how do we allow access and security to this data with the same people who had access and security issues with it when it was on paper.
Mr. Chairman, ask
where's the agreement?
Thank you. Who owns that data?
Chair Buckley, Representative Greenlich, there's a sequence that's tied to age. The school and student and really the parent owns the data up until the time that the student is 18 years of age. So currently, if a student wants to send transcript data to a college, they have to initiate a process that is either signed by them after their 18th birthday or by their parent if it's before their 18th birthday in order to submit it then to an OUS institution. When it arrives at the campus, it belongs strictly to that campus. So, for example, we could not open up the record
to the university or to the student.
To the university. When the student submits it to the university, that record is the property and the responsibility of the specific university. So, if a student applies only to OSU, for example, that record cannot be shared with the University of Oregon. The student would have to give separate permission for any information to be shared, and would have to submit a separate record to the University of Oregon if they chose to allow that access.
So the student, if I can follow up, the student then loses ownership by submitting it as a part of the process?
Chair Buckley, Representative Greenlick, it's probably not accurate to say they lose ownership of it. What they give permission for is the use of that information by the university that then has security responsibility for it. And there are already statewide policies about the use of that data, both the you know required uses, but also the limitations to the use of that data in order to make decisions on the student's behalf. What that doesn't mean is that the university owns that data and you know in essence can do what they choose with it. The student has to give permission to allow that data to be accessible elsewhere, and in fact, they can. There are processes in each of our campuses, at least, that allow a student to deny the use of that information for anything beyond sort of the specific sort of admission and placement decisions that might be made from it.
I follow up again.
Representative Greenlick.
Who owns the data?
Chair Buckley, Greenlick, ultimately it is still the student after their 18th birthday that does own that data.
Thank you.
Just to clarify a little bit here, so a student, for instance, who wants to send their high school transcripts on to university, do they have to go through their high school to have the high school send it to the university, or they have access at home to send it?
No, Chair Buckley, the process is still the same as it is currently, which is they have to access it through the high school. So they would have to contact typically a registrar or a counseling office in the high school itself and make a formal request with signature that allows them to then request the release of that data to particular institutions. So the procedure is very much the same as it is now. And, in fact, most of the high schools we're working with won't change their request procedure except to have the student indicate that, in fact, they want it electronically or if they have a purpose to send it by paper, they can choose to do that still.
Okay, and just to clarify, that from what I understand from your exchange with Representative Greenlick, there's no difference then between electronic transcripts or paper transcripts in terms of what a institution of higher ed can or cannot do with them without the student's permission?
Chair Buckley, that's correct, yes.
Okay. Please continue.
So as we continue to initiate the process, we are working with the primary student information systems in the state, and we really focused on a couple of parameters. First off, we were looking for volume. There are three major information systems in Oregon that consist of roughly 60 to 65% of the students in the state. So those were obvious targets for us to work with initially. If we can get those systems online, we get the highest volume of students right off the bat. The other parameter, though, we looked at, and this was as we were developing our project plan, is to look geographically to make sure that we had representation in other regions of the state. One of the problems we found right off the bat was that those primary information systems tend to be only up and down the Willamette Valley. So in terms of students that might be in the region out in eastern Oregon or in the southern part of the state or along the coast, those were sort of secondary tier, smaller scale vendors typically. And so we're in fact targeting those as well to make sure that we make that accessible for as many schools as possible. Then we have a third level option that is probably of more limited utility, but we're trying to make this universally acceptable to all or accessible for all high schools. So we do have a process for them to just use a simple spreadsheet through Microsoft Excel that will allow them to do data entry if they choose to. If they have, you know, particular students in mind, smaller populations, it may be that tool is as much as they might choose to use. But we are making sure that at least the option for submission of transcripts is available for every high school and every student if they choose to use it. Some of the processes we'll have to grant will be more streamlined and straightforward than others, just based on the size of the systems, the scope of the high school's capabilities in terms of data systems and support. But we are, in fact, at least making it available to everyone. We are in the process now of identifying next step partners, and this is a voluntary process on the part of the high school. And we can build a system, but we can't make them drink, so to speak. So, in essence, we've got to convince the high schools that this is to their advantage. Now, on the positive side, there are readily obvious advantages to using this system, and so if we can provide the technology and infrastructure, and that's what our project has tried to do, and have a fairly straightforward procedure in terms of both training staff and making sure that implementation is straightforward and easy, the benefits both in terms of time but also in terms of potential advantages for students are pretty readily evident. Up to now, we have not had significant pushback from any high schools, either about the time investment that's required, which is pretty minimal at this point, or in terms of some of the other issues that might come up around security and things like that. So far, we've had universally good acceptance of this process. We have scheduled on the calendar now implementation with all of Portland Public Schools and all of Beaverton School District in the next 2 months. We actually expect to get all of Clackamas and Multnomah County schools pulled in. We're currently working with Willamette ESD in order to get their regional partners involved. And so we think we can ramp up in relatively quick scale. These pilot schools that I just mentioned that are coming up, as we complete them and are certain that our program is operating properly, then we can rapidly ramp up and train a lot of schools and pull them into the system in pretty short order. So that's sort of the next agenda item, is we think we can hit our targets in terms of student availability and import into the system over the next couple of months here. The other component of this that's important is this is stage one in a longer-term vision for data transfer in the state. This piece allows us to begin to move student information in ways that are much more efficient for us, both from the high school side but also on the post-secondary side. And so this gives us the opportunity to use more comprehensive records about students than have ever been available before. In the short term, what that means is that it provides sort of enhanced abilities to do things like advising, potential placement, to really begin to think about making decisions about students in more systematic ways using a much richer set of data than we've had in the past. And traditional admission practices and policies around the country have tended to focus primarily on things like numbers of course credits in particular subject areas, GPAs, sometimes some national assessments like the SAT or ACT, and that's about it, because the ability to enter that data off of a paper transcript and then use it in any sort of systematic way has been limited. This system allows us potentially the abilities to look at a much deeper picture of students in order to connect them with services and make sure that they in fact appear to be prepared for the things that that we as adults are recommending they're going to enter. So we're just on the forefront of being able to do that. This has been a barrier. Even things like our state assessment system that provide useful information about student capabilities have been completely unavailable up until now. And we've done some research in terms of connecting those things, and we know that roughly 25% of students who move on to OUS and even more in the community colleges never even demonstrated the basic 10th grade benchmarks that the state currently assesses. They don't do very well, not surprisingly. Our ability to intervene in advance of a student taking a math course, for example, and suggesting that perhaps they need to know where the math lab is before they fail their first class instead of after, really are the kinds of enhancements that we think that this system potentially provides for us. And so it's hard to overstate, I think, the potential power of this. But in the long-term picture, even more globally, this gives us the ability to begin to track student progress across the sectors in ways that have been totally impossible in the past. So as we begin to look at things like program improvement and what does college preparation really look like, this lets us dive much more deeply into the backgrounds of students and the sorts of things that they're taking, the experiences they're having, and really start to pinpoint the areas of either recommendations in terms of what they are in fact prepared to move on and do, and to intervene much sooner in terms of high school counseling, the placement issues in terms of whether they're prepared to take on track credits or need remediation. We can be, I think, much clearer with them sooner than we've been able to be with the limited data that we had access to in the past. So in the larger scale of things, we really are looking at sort of longitudinal data in a much different way, and that connects specifically with some of the things that the Department of Education is working on, both in terms of their K-16 integrated data transfer system, KIDS, but also in terms of some of the partnerships in terms of how we're connecting the two together.
Very good. Questions, gentlemen?
Representative Crummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got quite a few. how far back, actually, I guess this is more along the lines of the Atlas system, and I don't know, Mr. Inslee, if you or Mr. Cossie can answer this question, or Mr. Merced would be better, but how far back will the systems go in terms of the information that is available on it? So if a student wanted to, I guess this is really with the Atlas, if a student wanted to look at their to see how they would stack up with a with an institution on a particular degree program. I mean, will it go back to the mid-90s? Will it go back to the 60s? Will it go back to last year?
Chair Buckley, Representative Crummell, my understanding from talking with the campus people is that their goal currently is to mirror current practice. They currently have articulation agreements, and they tend to carry them for about 7 years, seven catalog years. And so there will be certainly exceptions when students come back into the system after a long hiatus, but it really won't change the impact any more than the current system does, where there is, in fact, some intervention in certain instances that has to take place. Some people will still continue to have to talk to an advisor.
Okay. And if I may, Mr. Chair, you mentioned the move away from the Social Security number. Thank you. Very good. Glad to see that. We should never be using that. It was never intended to be an identifier for anybody, and everybody started picking it up. And I like the idea of it being with the same SSID number that they use for their state assessment. So once a student is assigned that SSID in kindergarten or whenever they start the state assessments, I guess right now it's third grade, then they carry that with them. I like that. But with regards to the data, you know, security, and you mentioned this a little bit, security is a very huge issue. So if you have a network that's not a closed network that that is, people can get on to, student can initiate, send a request to their high school, ask for the data to be transferred. So obviously, this is available on the wider network than just, you know, within a school or within a system. So what's protecting that data so that to keep the hackers? You know, we know from reports that we got in JLCIMT during the last interim that, you know, the state is attacked on a pretty regular basis. How are we securing that data so that for two areas? Number one, keep the hacker from getting it while it's sitting on a server somewhere. But the other thing is keeping the hackers from getting it when it's in transit from one from, you know, Gresham High School to Oregon State University.
Chair Buckley, Representative Crummell, sort of the details of security are beyond my expertise, but I can summarize what they mean. In essence, there are a couple levels to your question. First off, the data, as it stands currently, is already stored electronically. The difference is how does it get there in the first place and what scope is there in terms of high school information especially. But every one of our campuses already has dedicated IT staff whose focus is security. Their current Banner student information systems, in fact, are behind heavy firewalls because they have student records with secure information. And so, you know, those security practices don't change. The fact that we're adding high school data, more comprehensive high school data, to that full record doesn't change the need for, you know, the highest levels of security in terms of the data that sits at the campus level now. So there is, in fact, no sort of new security area, in essence, that has to be created because the data is still going to the same place it went before, is still stored in the same ways. It's just we've added some elements to it now. In terms of the transit, we are currently using a secure FTP process, and I can't tell you exactly how that works, except that I'm assured that that's the industry standard. It's the same sorts of things that banks use and anyone else who's sending secure information across the web. And so we're you know, buying security certificates, and there's a whole process of authentication that has to take place at the high school level. So part of the training and implementation of this is that we have to authenticate down to the level of the specific machine that's authorized to send the data, not just because of hackers, but because we don't want to be in the business of having to translate whether the transcript came from a student's desktop at home or from their high school counselor. And so there's a whole set of protocols there as well. So really what we're doing is taking a secure system at the high school level that's already well protected behind their own local firewalls, sending it to a secure area on the post-secondary side, and that conduit is through that secure FTP process that you know, is as secure as any electronic information can be.
It's questionable, Mr. Chair, about how secure FTP is, but I'll give you that one. I mean, it's probably I don't know that it's the most, but at any rate, the information is encrypted and it's protected, and it's, you know, so it's going to be a little bit of a struggle for a hacker to be able to get to it. That's what I'm basically after. May I follow up? With regards to the transfer of data between schools, is there the ability of things gurgling on us? Is there the ability of there to be a transfer of data this way between school districts? So, for example, if you had a student that was at Crater High School in wherever Crater High School is in Roseburg, and they wanted to then transfer to, or they were transferring to Sheldon High School in Eugene, they would be able to, their data, instead of it, you know, the school in Crater having to, you know, box it up, ship it off, they could transfer it electronically. So when the student arrives at Sheldon High School, the data is actually there. So that now the counselor can see what the student's taken, what they're, so on and so forth.
Chair Buckley, Representative Crummell, I'm going to defer that question to my colleague, Mr. Costi.
Chair Buckley, Representative Crummell, in response to your question, what you're describing is a component of the K-12 Integrated Data System Project, and that is to create the ability to create an electronic transcript of sorts and to move those data securely between districts through a secure process following specific policies, much like Mr. Ensley laid out in terms of following the paper process. That's what we're following in the K-12 environment as well, following those same security policies and procedures.
So currently, if a student is transferring, can the data be transferred electronically so that the data arrives when the student arrives?
Chair Buckley, Representative Crummell, the capacity to do that will be in place by the end of this fiscal year. It is currently being developed as part of the pilot. We're going to do our first test of that pilot at the end of March. So at that point in time, that transfer module will be in place.
And then finally, Mr. Chair, are you building into the system the ability of the students, the parents, to have access to the information? And in the school that I teach in, one of the greatest things that we've got is parents can go on, we're talking to students, but the parents can go on, they can go to their student's record, they can see how many days the student's been present, how many they've been absent, they can see what kind of absences they've had, whether they're excused or unexcused, they can see what kind of, they can see what their grades are, they can see what their scores are, they can see what the teacher feedback has been on reports and projects that the students have done. So I'm just curious, you know, is there...
I would have hated to have been a student under those circumstances.
Is there... Yeah, well, me too. Me too. Believe me. But is there the...
Holy backer.
Is there the ability of a parent to be able to go and see what their students' grades are, for example? I mean, maybe they don't want to see all the other stuff, but just a grade.
Representative, or Chair Buckley, Representative Crummell, this actually comes back to the question earlier from Representative Greenlick. And you're talking to some degree about a separate system that already exists. There is the capability already at our campuses for students to open an account and access their own records. They can look at their grades, their coursework, they can register online, and any number of functions that already exist at our campuses. But the student owns the data after their 18th birthday. So parents don't have access to that unless they convince their student to give them access to it. So, yes, in fact, there is a functionality that would allow that, and it is, in fact, already built in to existing processes at least all of our campuses, and I suspect many of the community colleges as well. But there is that question of who gets to look at it.
Absolutely. I guess I maybe should have directed my question more to Mr. Costi, because I'm really curious about this in a K-12 environment, if a parent can access the information.
Chair Buckley, Representative Crummell, what I think you described is spotty. I mean, that capacity is there in certain areas of the state.
Okay.
Not every school district supports that type of functionality for their parents. You assume additional roles and responsibilities when you take that on. That, again, is another one of those areas where Kids Phase 3, the next project for the kids, the statewide implementation, would add value to the state. So it would provide a certain level of functionality. From a K-12 perspective, we are serving data back to the front door of the district, and then it becomes the district's responsibility in terms of how they use that. Our recommendation is they would begin by sharing that data with district and school administrators and classroom teachers and get that part right before they try to push that out to the parents.
Sure. My son's high school does have a program called Power School, mm-hmm. where parents can log on. You can see your kids' grades and all the information you're referring to. And as Representative Greenlink said, my son hates it. He absolutely hates it. But as a parent, it's wonderful to be able to have access to that information after their 18th birthday. Did you have anything else, Mark? Were you kind of wrapped up? Or
Chair Buckley, yes, I'm.
I had one question in terms of the seamlessness of what we're working from K through 16. The data that you're developing in the elementary schools as they lead up, it's up to the schools themselves to put it in the format that the colleges want it in. I mean, basically, all you're just providing the data. The schools are responsible for putting it into a transcript form the colleges will accept. Do I have that correct?
Chair Buckley, Mark might be better to answer this question since it does relate to that side of the project.
Yeah, Chair Buckley, a major part of the process working with our partners is, in fact, working individually with each information system to develop that extract process. So every one of them is coded somewhat differently. As you would expect, they have different practices in how they represent things. So we have to go to work with each of the systems in order to make sure that we have the same parameters, we're getting the same kind of data, that it's organized in the same way. That actually is converted at our level into a different language then that in fact the national colleges use all across the country and that our campuses are set up to receive. So there's a whole series of sort of data coordination that happens first at the high school level with the student information system there, into a standardized format that, in fact, is parallel to what the state is using for their kids project. And then we translate it yet again in order to allow the colleges to read it. And it sounds like a lot of hurdles, but from the school's perspective, what that does is minimize the number of changes they have to make, and it puts the burden of those changes on the system and the statewide agencies as opposed to the individual schools and districts.
Very good. Very good.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenlink.
Just a brief question, please. I've heard twice or maybe three times now that the schools are keeping the same security systems in place as if it were paper. I assume that's a temporary phenomenon, that those security systems can be more modified for electronic models. Is that?
Can I speak to that? Chair Buckley, Representative Greenlink, from a K-12 perspective, the storing of individual student and now staff data has become a phenomenon. The Family Education and Educational Rights and Privacy Act is being reviewed currently by the feds because of that scenario. And they recognize that FERPA was designed in a paper age and that they need to get to appropriate policy for an electronic age. So the feds are starting that movement in terms of reviewing those policies and procedures. And we're expecting something in the next couple of years to give us a push or a nudge in the right direction to accommodate those new requirements.
Thank you. Gentlemen, anything else you'd like to offer?
Thank
you very much for the information. I appreciate it very much. We have a few minutes left. I'm not sure. I don't think we have a sign up, but if anybody in the audience wanted to have a chance to speak on this information, why don't you come on up?
Hi, I'm Denise Sutton. I'm from the coast. Can you hear me okay?
Denise, can you spell Sutton for us, please?
S-U-T-T-O-N.
Thank you.
The reason I wasn't going to even talk today, when somebody encouraged me to come up, I been taking classes over 20 years, and Lynn Benton lost my transcripts. And I just got out of class today from a psychology class that I aced taking a test years ago that I have to repeat, and the instructor won't give me anything higher than a B because I haven't my, she was saying because of my dyslexia, I need to proofread my essays a little bit better. And normally I'm not a test taker, and so I'm thinking I aced these courses already, and these transcripts were on paper, and Lynn Benton somehow when OCC went, when they went to OCC or something like that back in the day, because I've been taking classes for a lot of years, things got lost. So I'm taking over $1,000 this year right now of courses that I have to repeat. And I'm not eligible for financial aid because I have a learning disability and I can only take so many courses at once. If I take a full load, I'll just fully get overwhelmed. And so needless to say, this is really a great program. It's a great start in getting rid of some redundancy because I sat down with the guidance counselor recently for the first time ever, and I realized that I was taking things I didn't need. I have a whole bunch more credits than I need to graduate. I could probably have graduated already, you know. And so this is going to really help people not have to deal with some of the redundancy there. Also, there was classes that I could have supplemented that I wasn't aware of. I hate history, and I learned that I could take political science, and it could relate to some of the current federal and state issues that we were working on. And so, you know, instead of learning about something that happened a thousand years ago, I'm learning, you know, and I can supplement a little bit and play around with the classes and not have to be stuck in such a rigid, you know, coursework. And so this is really important because, again, you know, you have people like me who, you know, kind of fall through the cracks, basically, and they are in school a lot longer than they need to be. And so hopefully this will help make a positive change so that nobody else will have to go out of pocket like we have. And my visa is just screaming. Right now it's just like we're ready to take out a loan to pay off it because it's not a lot of fun. I don't have money for these classes, and then I just give the colleges my plastic and say, oh, just charge it. And then, you know, it is. It's very expensive, especially when you've already taken the courses and things get lost. Paper gets lost. I mean, and this way this will keep that from happening to somebody else. And that's all I wanted to say.
Thank you. As long as they back it up.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, my kids are getting ready for college, and we can't afford to put three of us through. So it's getting really hard out there. So maybe this will help more kids, you know, out there, you know, get their degrees and not have to go through what I went through. Just an old-timer that's still taking college courses that I already took. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, that also reminds me, being a fan of Doonesbury all my life, I remember Zonker during the Vietnamese War accidentally meeting his requirements and being forced to graduate.
Oh, that poor guy, yeah.
This would be a really good way to make sure you never met him.
That's right, that's right. For the eternal student, it's true. I'm going to go ahead and close this informational hearing on the Education Subcommittee on Higher Education. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I do remember the horrible look on Zonker's face when the registrar told him he had just met all the departments.
Are these all...